Welcome along this weekend. La Liga started with great enthusiasm, tailed off a bit and slumped over the line, a bit like Terry in one of his 18-hour shifts on La Liga TV. Or in fact, in this podcast, not that anyone knows, because by the time we get to Granada versus Osasuna, there'll only be 10 people left listening. In today's professional broadcast environment, one of my set of neighbours have got landscapers digging up a patio, and that way they've got people taking down the scaffolding. But let's see what we can rescue. After all, we had three stunning comebacks this weekend. Sevilla, Atleti, or Real Madrid, all two down, all got something from their games. And then we got to Sunday night's action, including Barcelona, whose performance on a frozen pitch at Alaves can best be summed up as, spare a thought for Franco Russo against Villarreal, the Mallorca defender, scored an own goal, gave away a penalty, and was sent off. It's only football. We can laugh about it, Franco. Mario Immerso can also smile after a defensive performance that reminded me of Atleti before Simeone was salvaged by a dramatic winning goal. But poor old Karim Benzema, actually the worst weekend of all. He missed a penalty, got injured, and then found out that his house had been robbed while he was away. So best of luck to him. Terry is in a hotel in Barcelona. It looks very neutral, Terry, for podcast listeners. How is it? How is Barcelona in the winter?
It's quite chilly, actually. I'm glad I bought a coat this time. Mm-hmm. It's not raining, though, so it's quite bright but chilly. So it's and that's what I've seen of it. As you people probably know, we do a pretty long shift on the Saturday and the Sunday, and I'm back in this evening. So it's good fun being here, but I'm not a tourist when I come to Barcelona to work. It's very much studio sleep, and then I'm flying backwards and forwards. So yeah. I'm grateful to be doing it, but grateful for the fact that the games were pretty decent until Sunday evening.
Yeah, and then a taxi back to the wrong terminal, and you're away.
Yeah. Could be anywhere in the morning.
Right, well, let's start. Let's start well and tail off, like the La Liga weekend. Shall we start with Atletico versus Valencia? Because it was an absolute belter of a finish, wasn't it? Actually, that was almost the opposite, wasn't it? It was a scrappy old start, and then Valencia scored their goals, and the various iterations of Atleti that we saw eventually won the game.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great game, first and foremost, a great game to be involved commentating on, because something was happening throughout the match, and whether it was the initial start by Atletico, which was poor, and then, you know, going behind, and then Simeone coming under criticism because of the substitutions he made when they were 2-0 down, and then ultimately they paid off, and João Félix was probably, and Thomas Lemar, when they got substituted, the jeers and boos were quite evident. But it worked. That's why Simeone is the highest paid manager in the world. He makes decisions that he probably is aware of at the time that they might not be popular, but he believes it's the right choices. But to analyse Atletico is so hard these days. And I think it's an interesting subject on the podcast this week about managers trying these systems where they tried like a hybrid version of a back three and a back four. Mm. And it ends up complicating it. Xavi is the same. When we talk about Barcelona, I'll talk about a post-match interview Xavi gave after the game. And Simeone is that. And our job as a co-commentator is to try and analyse the lineup and the team shape. It's not always clear. There's more often than not, in all these games this weekend, there's one player where you think, well, where is he going to be playing? And he is going to be key to whether they're playing a 4-4-2 or 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1, and that's our job to try and spot that. And when you do Atletico, you're looking at it for the first 10 or 15 minutes, I'm thinking, is it a 3 or is it a 4? Mm. No, it's a 3. No, it's a 4. No, Brasalico's playing right-sided centre-back in a 3.
Let me put the formation up, but this is wrong. Right, I have to share the screen. So this is 4. So we'll talk it through it for podcast listeners. Patreons can see the screen that we are about to nick from ass.com. Thank you to our friends at ass. This is really good, by the way, ass.com. And you look under the statistics section of a game, and these are the formations. But, Terry, it's going to be misleading, isn't it? Because this is over the course of their performance, on their time on the pitch. But it kept changing, didn't it? So tell us what are they doing?
Well, Rodrigo de Paul ended up right back.
Yeah, that's and why his average position is here, isn't it? Yeah.
And in the interview, post-match interview, Simeone was so confused. He said, and ended up playing Rodrigo de Paul at left back. No, it was right back. He did play fullback, but it was at right back. And I mean, what you're seeing there, as you say, it's over 90 minutes because Carrasco, I think he's 21, isn't he? He didn't play in that position for the majority of the game. He was one of the players that I thought was a possible wing back. It's Vasilico, he's 24, I think. You can see him there. But if he was playing as a genuine right back, where is the other centre back alongside Jimenez? I think opinion was the idea at the start was Hermoso, left back, left sided centre back, number 22, number two Jimenez, number 24 Vasilico. They played as a three, but it kept changing. And what I'll go on to Xavi now. He said they worked on a 4-3-3 and a 3-4-3 to prepare for whatever Alaves played. Now, immediately, my mind's thinking, since when have Barcelona adopted different tactics to play against Alaves? So that was the first thing. And then I'm looking at it and thinking, the players, and this goes to Atletico, they look confused defensively. So that players are they're not aware of their own responsibility throughout 90 minutes, and they're not aware of their teammates' responsibility over 90 minutes. So therefore, that's why you get the complications defensively that we're seeing from Atletico, because to try and do this hybrid three, I kind of got it when back in the Barcelona days when Pep was manager and other teams do it consistently with who have got a specific central holding midfield player. So you will have the full-backs push high up the pitch, the centre-back split, and let's use Busquets, for instance, in that classic Barcelona team. He would drop in and make three centre-backs when they're in possession of the ball. So at times, I got that hybrid version of a back four and a back three. But now we're not seeing a defensive midfield player drop into the between the centre-backs. We're seeing one of the full-backs sort of moving laterally across to make a three and the other one pushing on. So therefore, you really do need a real firm understanding, which I don't think Atletico have got, where instead of playing a three or a five or a four, it's like a crossover between at times it's going to be three, at times it's going to be four, and we're going to rotate it around and one pushes on and one. So you're asking players to have a lot of responsibility and concentration, and it's complicated. Because there will be times where both the wing-backs go and one of the full-backs, like Vasilico, kind of forgets he's a right-sided centre-back and he goes over to a right-back position, which then leaves one centre-back and one the other one playing on the left. So there's big gaps. And I think with Atletico, with the success they've had in the past, with a three and with a four, they're better off knowing a system of play as opposed to trying to mix and match between two. And I think that was a problem for Atletico. I think it's a problem for Barcelona still. And there's too many gaps, basically, that allow teams to hit them. The second goal, I mean, the first goal for Hermoso is the left-sided centre-back and he gets caught on the right and he slides in, or he gets caught when he slides in and goes to ground and commits himself, thinks he's been fouled. And there's a massive gap then for Valencia to break into. And suddenly you've got, you know, Yunus Musa on the ball with Vasilico dropping deep and not going out and confronting him and allowing him to cut inside and shoot with his right foot to score. The second goal from Atletico was Jimenez and Hermoso getting in each other's way. And then one of them, I think it was Jimenez, wildly lashing at the ball. It goes up in the air.
No, it's Hermoso.
And then,
he hoofs it up in the air, doesn't Hermoso, he? Straight up in the air. Yeah.
And then how does Hugo Duro get through in the centre of the penalty area with time and space to have a touch and finish it off? And how was the pass from a Valencia player, I can't remember who it was, just threading it through, finding space in that part of the penalty box. So very unlike Atletico. So I think that's the theme I took from this weekend, that the new thing from some coaches is to try and have a hybrid version where it's not always a four, it's not always a three, it can be a five, it can be this. And you know what? Sometimes, most of the time, it's a mess. It doesn't work. And I think they need to simplify it. And, you know, particularly Xavi, because it's a new job and he's trying new ideas and we want to see an idea of what he's trying to achieve and where he's trying to get to. And now we're seeing it's all over the place. So I think that's the theme I've taken from the weekend. But
One of my fears,
I loved it.
On this, though, before we get to because one of my fears on this is that a lot of tactics are dictated by the very strongest teams, and that's what everyone follows. It's one of my general problems with how football develops. I think it's the same in English football as well, I would say. Everyone looks at, say, Pep and Man City or something, or Bayern Munich, and draw their tactics from there. But I'm thinking, yeah, but hang on, that team is full of brilliant players.
Yeah. World-class players.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the fashion from Pep was the fullbacks pushing forward into inside forward position, was it into a more inside midfield position. Teams started doing that. So I agree with you totally. And it was fun after that. I mean, Atletico, I've been critical of how they played, how they started the game. But then they went for it, hell for leather, the substitutions made, players all over the place. I had fun with Andy West, who's commentating, who likes the idea of a team shape, and he likes the idea of us picking up where a player's changed or a manager's made a tactical change. And I'd say to him, Andy, leave it. It's going to change again in a minute. Because trying to analyse the substitutions being made, it was ridiculous. I mean, to the fact that Rodrigo de Paul was right back and Hermoso scores the winning goal, and I immediately thought it was Luis Suarez in that position. It's a tap-in for a number nine. It's not a tap-in for a player who was playing God knows where at that time. How he was there, I don't know. Why he was there, to score the goal. But it was sometimes the technical and tactical coaching manual is just ripped up before our very eyes. It's just a question to get as many offensive players on the pitch as possible, running the risk of conceding a goal. But at the same time, you're looking at Valencia, if you're Simeone, and thinking, nothing's coming back the other way. They're not hurting us anymore. Mm. So we can risk pushing players forward. We're 2-0 down. Let's go for it. Let's have a bit of belief. Let's try and get some momentum, get the crowd going. And when they get the first goal, then the whole dynamic of the game changes. Suddenly, an unknown as a coach and as a player, that 2-goal lead is fragile. As soon as you concede one, the whole dynamic of the game changes. And it's really hard sometimes to stop it, to stop that momentum, particularly when you're playing away from home and you're playing in certain stadiums. There are stadiums where it's slightly easier. But when you're playing at the Wanda or you're playing at the Sanchez Pizjuan or the Bernabeu, where the comeback happened this week, then suddenly the crowd buy into it and you're under pressure. And Atletico steamrolled Valencia in the end and somehow managed to get the goals. Cunha with the first. I'm going back at so many goals this weekend. Cunha with the first in 63rd minute.
Yeah.
And then Correa's won another substitute. Come on, he gets the 90th minute goal player that probably should be starting games. And Hermoso in the 92nd minute. So it's, teams have belief. And then once the supporters get that belief, it's hard for Valencia to turn that tide around. I was slightly disappointed in Bordalas keep bringing on young players because he had other players on the bench that he could have used. It was almost like him saying to the people above him at Valencia, I've only got kids to put on. When he didn't, he had Denis Cheryshev, Marcos Andre could have come on and, had a bit more experience. But he chose to keep putting young players on and the experiment of trying to hold on with a team full of young players didn't pay off in the end. So it was tough on Valencia, but I'd be interested to know. I mean, we talk about, I like to see shapes and I like to see organisation and teams. I think it's really important that they do have an understanding of a general style of what they're playing. And I don't mind flexibility in terms of some weeks are three and some weeks are four. But it would be interesting to an experiment to start a game like Atletico finished it. You're pretending you're 2-0 down and you're, players are playing out of position all over the place and you're getting the ball forward far quicker than you normally do because that's how and where you're going to score a goal. It would be interesting to see how an opposing team would react to Hermoso playing up front, Rodrigo de Paul playing up right back and Suarez and Cunha and Correa all playing on the same pitch and just players all over the place. We used to have a saying in pretty much a mantra in every single game I play, that turn them round for the first 20 minutes, whichever team I played for, turn them round. The other team would have been doing the same. Let's turn them round for the first 20 minutes, earn the right to play, which meant you knew it was going to be get the ball forward quickly, win that battle. If you won that battle, the opposing team might then take a step back and drop off Then the game opened up, and then you found yourself with more time to play your football, more time to get your more skillful players into the game. There'd be more space. And it was trying to earn that right to be the dominant team. We don't see that very much now. You know, it's not something that's done. It's you get an easing into the game from both teams, unless it's one of a big difference in quality. Not many teams dominate from the off and start fast and start furious and start with that tempo that you're chasing the game. But it'd be a great experiment. It wouldn't work because this 50,000 supporters would have to pretend along as well. They'd have to pretend you're 2-0 down and you're kicking off the game. But
supporters want that, don't they?
10 minutes to score a goal.
What strikes me about supporters now is that we've now learned, we've been like conditioned by defensive-minded coaches, I think, haven't we? You know, supporters used to urge their own team on. Now, you see a player pass the ball back to his own goalkeeper, you know, he's like, he's under a bit of pressure and he sidesteps someone, passes it back to and everyone claps him. You just get booed for passing the ball back to your own goalkeeper. And now, oh, well done. Really good back pass, mate. Well played.
Okay. And then the goalkeeper doesn't even reach with his kick out, doesn't reach where the defender has passed it back from.
Yeah, he could have just kicked it out of play, couldn't he? Yeah. Or kicked it up in the air, because that's effectively where you've got to. Anyway.
But it is interesting, but you have to have the stadium, you have to have the supporters. As I said, if you were 2-0 up at Villarreal, the atmosphere might not be the same. I'm not criticising Villarreal, but I'm just talking about the weekend comebacks came from teams that have a partisan support. So Sevilla, when they're behind against Celta, when they get the Paco Gomez gets the goal, suddenly the crowd comes to life, the stadium changes, the Bernabeu with Real Madrid. It's one of the reasons why Real Madrid are successful a number of times in terms of a comeback because people buy, their supporters buy into it. Suddenly you've got 60, 70, 80,000 supporters that believe in their team and put the pressure on. There'll be clubs in England that are, you know, exactly the same. So it does play a part.
Let's stay at the Bernabeu, Terry, since you mentioned it. They got away with it, didn't they, against Elche? Because Elche were two up. And they were a threat going the other way, weren't they, Elche, crucially against Real Madrid? Benzema's penalty miss obviously would have been a very different game if that had hit the back of the net. But then Real Madrid do what Real Madrid do, and you know they kept going. Modric got a penalty, Militao with an excellent header, I thought, stoppage time, isn't it, right at the end of the game.
Yes.
But they got away with it. Credit to Elche, it was a really good game.
Yep, 91st minute equaliser, Militao. Mm. So they did leave it late. Modric didn't score until the 81st minute. So that's how well Elche were doing. And Elche showed enough ability on the ball, didn't they? That when the game did slow down a touch, Real Madrid can't keep that tempo up for 90 minutes, particularly in the second half when they're chasing the game. When it did drop, Elche were able to string together some passes and move up the pitch. And they had the game's, I think, outstanding player in Lucas Boyo. It was a really interesting subject because it's a player who's at Reading, not people many know. I don't remember him.
I saw him at Reading.
Celta.
Yeah.
He's 25 years of age.
At Reading, I saw him play and I thought, I can see there's a good player in there, but you know, he didn't. It was the Championship's a funny old league. You know, it's a fast, physical league. Reading weren't great. And you're sort of thinking that there's sort of a decent player trapped there. But we didn't really see that when he was in England.
No. And I think he's a victim of... He's 25 now. A victim of... He's played for AEK Athens. He's played a number of clubs. And started in Argentina with River Plate, Torino, Celta Vigo, Newell's, Old Boys, AEK Athens and Reading. And then at the age of 25. So that's a lot of clubs. Most of them have been on loan. And just sometimes the progression of a young player suffers because they're playing in different countries. They're not playing on a regular basis. And I don't know what his situation was at Reading. But when I see him now, I look at all the attributes you need to be a striker. And now he's scoring goals. And his hold-up play is fantastic. The way he pins himself against centre-backs. I thought he gave Militao and Alaba a really tough game. I think Militao was really poor. Fantastic goal that he scored, but he was really poor. We saw his frustration because he couldn't make a clean challenge. So ended up fouling Lucas Boye and giving away, getting a yellow card. That was born out of frustration because it's not often that I complained about Maxi Gomez the other week, didn't I, against Real Madrid, saying he weren't backing in, he didn't hold the ball up. He was not keeping the ball, it kept coming back. Then the other way, so Valencia in the end up getting pummeled by Real Madrid. But that wasn't the case with Lucas Boye. Maybe Lucas Perez, he wasn't as efficient. But Lucas Boye, he scored the goal, decent goal, determined run to get on the end of the cross from Fidel. But his all-round game was excellent. Great first touch, protects the ball well, and has the ability to twist and turn to get away from the centre-back. So it'd be interesting to see how other clubs view him, because everyone's always looking for that type of striker. And now one that's scoring goals, playing for Elche's. I thought he was superb. He could have gone with, I think, Gonzalo Verdú, the centre-back, probably had the game of his life. 25 minutes to go, he's 33, he's not a regular. He had his hands on his knees, he was huffing and puffing, and I'm thinking he's got no chance. 2 minutes later, he's sprinting across the pitch and making a last-ditch tackle. There was great spirit from Elche, good quality. I wouldn't go as far as to say they deserve the two-goal lead because they didn't have many attempts on goal. But I think in general play, their quality was evident. They looked organised, well-coached. And in Gumbau and Raul Guti midfield, they coped with being outnumbered by Casemiro, Modric and Kroos. So I thought Elche were excellent. It's some half-decent teams that we thought were fighting relegation of climbing their way out. And it's becoming quite apparent that the weaker teams in the league that are going to be fighting it out to stay in the division. I think Elche will be safe. Two games against Real Madrid in the space of 3 or 4 days. One of them went to extra time, and then they were unlucky not to hold on and get all 3 points against Real Madrid. So it's not easy. When you're Elche, you get a new manager, you get a little run going, and then all of a sudden you've got to play Real Madrid twice in a week. You could suffer heavy defeats. Your confidence could be knocked and it could impact the rest of your season. But they've come out of it with pride and we're still with confidence. So for Real Madrid, it was a difficult one to assess. You wonder already whether Ancelotti continuing to play the same players all the time is going to take its toll. Benzema coming off with a hamstring. They did look slightly jaded. They did look slightly off the pace until they had to show that urgency and try and raise the tempo of the game to recover the two-goal deficit. Then we saw the true Real Madrid. But for an hour or so, it was a below-par performance where they did look a little bit jaded, not as sharp as normal. But their spirit, they never give up. And they managed to recover a point from that game. So I think the big talking point will be Hazard.
Yeah.
In his performance.
I think Guillaume described it as inconsequential. He did an analysis bit, and he hadn't used the screen before, had he? So he sort of drew a line around him. Then everyone moved, and the line, the little circle moved, and Hazard hadn't moved with it. And then he says, and he's there. That's not Hazard. And he's like, oh, no, it's not. Hang on. Anyway. Rather like Hazard's
performance.
It was
an interesting. Yeah, I mean, he was involved in the first goal, but there was his mistake. Lucas Vazquez made a mistake, and two centre backs made a mistake. That generally means you concede a chance, and more often than not, it might end up in the back end of the net. Three mistakes. That's what I'm saying. If you make one, two, three mistakes, it does end up normally with a half chance at least for the opposition, and that's what happened with Real Madrid. Hazard was at fault. He didn't track Mojica, who slid the ball into Fidel. When I say he didn't track him, he didn't get close enough to close him down. Lucas Vazquez came out of position. He's not a proper right back anyway, so he miscalculated that, left the space in behind, and then the two centre-backs have to deal better with the one striker attacking the ball in the middle of the goal. So three mistakes does invariably lead to conceding the goal, even if you're Real Madrid. So, but I think he's too restricted on the right wing. I think that's clear. And he's asked to play up and down in a straight line, which doesn't suit him. So as the first half progressed, he drifted inside and got more involved in the game. I think there was an element of they don't give him the ball enough. And then in the second half, I noticed, I've always thought there was a connection between him and Benzema, and I still think that's the case. And I thought yesterday when they actually ended up playing 4-4-2 and he was playing almost as a second striker off of Jovic, he got more involved with Modric, and I thought Modric liked using Hazard. So two great players. I mean, Modric is he's doing it week in, week out for Real Madrid. Hazard's struggling to find that form. But I thought you could see Modric recognise the fact that Hazard is the player to give the ball to, and they played combination play on three or four occasions, which nearly resulted in goals for Real Madrid. So it's getting him in his a position where you get the best out of him, and then getting him to feel confident, because I still think at times he plays safe because he doesn't want to give the ball away, which is doesn't mean you're going to get the best version of Hazard.
I've thought with him, Terry, the injuries in his whole time at Real Madrid has stopped that integration with him in the team. He's a complicated player, Hazard, isn't he? There are certain players you could say, right, what are such and such his qualities? You could drop Vinicius into any team, I think, and pretty easily yes. The coach would say, yeah, he's fast, skillful, he's a really good player, he can finish. Oh, all right, okay, we'll stick him there. With Hazard...
Do what you do.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, he's got many, many qualities, but it's harder to... It's harder for him to integrate into a team when he hasn't had a consistent spell of staying fit at the club. And so this very brilliant but complicated player has always just looked a bit lost at Real Madrid. I don't know whether we'll ever see anything different, unfortunately.
Yep. No, I agree with you on all counts. I'm not sure that Ancelotti is going to have the confidence to play him for six games on the trot and not substitute him and allow him that time to... for these teammates to get used to him, for him to get used to them, and for him to get match fit and sharp and to get confident. That's what it's going to need. I don't think that will happen. It may change if Benzema is out for a period of time, but I think he's not the first player at Real Madrid that goes there and you're thinking, where's he going to play? Yeah. You know, his best position doesn't exist. Kaká, Isco, and now Hazard. You know, it's a difficult one to... Yeah, you know, teams should know that before they buy players, and Real Madrid are by no means the only club to do that. But I agree with you, Vinicius. You can just put him in that on that left wing position and say, "Do what you do," and everyone will recognise it. And you're not asking him to do anything different. With Hazard, with Kaká, with Isco, maybe you're asking them to adapt and change. So I agree with you totally. That's the case with Hazard. He's a great player. I really do like him, and I think that if Real Madrid were to recover him and get him back to his best and find his best position, the connection with Benzema, the connection with Modric, Toni Kroos, because they're on the same level. And I think that would make them, it would improve them, I think, as a team. As opposed to, is it Hazard? Is it Asensio? Is it Rodrigo? Mm. Would it be Fede Valverde playing in a midfield four? That it's the one position up for grabs, and I'm not sure Ancelotti has the belief that Hazard is the player. And I forgot Gareth Bale, of course, to be the player that can make a difference. I mean, we joke about Gareth Bale, but you know, Ancelotti, you know, puts him on the bench. I'm not sure he even warmed up, but you know, if you've got a fit Gareth Bale, his contract's running out, he makes goal scoring look easy. It's not impossible for him to play a part in the remaining months of the season. So
of this, Terry, we've only got 16 games left of this season, and then if we're all right, Mbappe comes in, and that's another place in the team gone, isn't it?
So exactly,
Right, shall we? Where haven't we been yet? Sevilla. Let's do Sevilla's 2-2 draw with Celta Vigo. It's a difficult one. So if you come in, you didn't know what happened in this game. You saw that they'd drawn at home to Celta Vigo. You'd say they'd messed it up and missed a real opportunity to have closed the gap. But a tired-looking team to fight back as they did leaves with a much more sort of optimistic feel at the end of the game.
I agree totally. I mean, I knew they'd players missing. Doing this game at the weekend, the Liga TV, you go into more detail and there's a ridiculous amount of players missing. I mean, they haven't got much of a bench, and they haven't had much of a bench for about three, four games now. So the same players playing all the time. So the injury list was Lamela, Suso, Delaney, Navas, Koundé, Augustinsson, and three players away on African Nations duty, Bono, Munir, and then Nesri. So Oliver Torres has been missing. He's come back into the group. So that's a lot of players in the amount of games they've had, but they keep playing the same ones. And ironically, it was one of those players that was rested. They've signed this Tecatito Corona, who looks lively, but then let Oscar Rodriguez go out on loan to Getafe. So he's come in, and so they played him at the weekend and were able to rest Papu Gomez. And yet, you know, until Papu Gomez comes on and scores that goal, Celta are winning. You know, and Celta are a decent team. Good attacking players, an attacking lineup, an unchanged lineup. They're used to playing with each other now. They're in a decent run of form. We know they have the potential to score goals and trouble any team in La Liga. So for them to race away into the two-goal lead, he thought it was a big ask. And nothing happened. Three changes at half-time from Sevilla, so it was positive. And they went for it. But they were finding hard to break them down. And as I said, the dynamic changes when you get the first goal, particularly when it's a spectacular one like Papu Gomez got. It was a fantastic finish. We've got some good goals at the weekend. That was in one of the better ones. And from then on, the whole game changes. The crowd, as I said earlier, buy into it. And it becomes a whole different prospect for Celta to hang on to. So no, I agree with you. I thought it was a really well-earned point by Sevilla. Although the game against Valencia dropping points, this game dropping points, you did feel then that Real Madrid, in all probability, were going to beat Elche. The league would be stretched. Would it be too far for Sevilla to come back from? Of course, as we know, it didn't turn out like that. And they're still in the race. So I think Oliver Torres hits the post and he scores, then hits the post with a diving header towards the end of the game. So they could have won the game. But I think, as Ancelotti said, it was a point won from a game that was lost. And I think that applies exactly to Sevilla as well.
Yeah. Whereas, weirdly, Barcelona actually win a game and go away feeling quite depressed about it. For podcast, Terry, one for TV viewers, we've lost you. You put your notes down over the top of your camera.
Sorry.
There we are. That's what the people are paying their money for, to see your face. So let's go to Barcelona. And they won the game. So, hey, everything's perfect, fine. But it was a scrappy old affair, wasn't it? Go on. Yeah, so go on. Tell us what Xavi had to say afterwards.
It was a dull match.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not often the case for Barcelona.
Yeah.
Or hasn't been for a decade or so. And it was a struggle. They were untidy. They gave the ball away 38 times in the first half. This is a game against Alaves, who are struggling for their lives. Who set up in a 4-5-1, no ambition really other than to stifle Barcelona. And yet Barcelona were giving the ball away cheaply. The movement off the ball wasn't good enough. There was a period of time where, and I'm going to keep harping on about because they're so far away from the Xavis and the Iniesta and Busquets period in midfield when those players were in possession of the ball when they had five options and they had to pick the best one. And more often than not, 99 times out of 100, they would pick the best option to play to. More often than not, it was Messi. So look, we can't ignore the fact Messi's not there anymore. But they did have numerous options to pick who they were going to pass and the next pass was going to go to. Looking at Barcelona's players now in the midfield, they're struggling to find a option. You know, it's you know, Pedri gets the ball and he's looking around and he's 18 years old and he's shouting and hollering at these teammates to move better off the ball. And he's trying to find one option. Not at picking the best one. He hasn't got any options. And it's just so lethargic and so lackadaisical and it's so slow, the build-up now, and so predictable that in amongst... I think Xavi's in a rush to get to where he wants to get to and he's trying to... Not cheat, that's the wrong word, but trying to take shortcuts to get there. And I think they need to go back to the fundamentals. And he took them out 3-4-3 and a 4-3-3. He's got to be realistic with the players that he's got. And I think they would be far better off with a structure in place that suits Barcelona to go forward. And it has to be the Barcelona style. We've seen a different forward attacking lineup. Frankie de Jong was brought back in because Gabby was suspended. So The personnel was pretty good. I mean, Piqué and Araujo at the back and Jordi Alba. Sergiño Dest coming in for Dani Alves, who had to be rested. De Jong and Busquets and Pedri in midfield. That's more than decent. Up front is a problem, isn't it? Ferran Torres is showing good signs. As you'd expect, they paid big money for him. But it's, you know, and then you've got Luke de Jong who does what Luke de Jong does, and then Abde is hit miss. So I think that they need a structure. And I looked at their lineup and I saw the three forwards all playing in a central role and Luke de Jong dropping deep, and the fullbacks, Dest didn't really push on much. Jordi Alba did a little bit more, but not as much as he has done in the past, which is understandable. And they just lacked that little spark. And obviously, they lacked the magic of one player who's gone. And I guess we've kind of forgotten that, the difference he made. He was the magic, wasn't he, of Barcelona. Originally, with Pep's team and surrounded by other magical players. But then as the years went on, he was the one, wasn't he, that was the match winner on his own and came up with that bit of magic when they could have been playing like they were last night and he scores two goals. And we all go away and talk about the performance of Messi rather than the performance of Barcelona. Messi's not there now. So they haven't got that little bit of magic that not gets them out of trouble, but that makes you sit there and watch them and anticipate that something extraordinary could happen. At the moment, not the case with this current Barcelona team.
Yeah, and he left a huge hole in terms of how good he is, in terms of the role that he played. This, as we were saying about Hazard, you know, it was all built around Messi. And obviously then there's no money with which, because you think, well, once Messi was gone, you'd replace it with some superstars, but there just isn't the team there, is there, to replace it with superstars. Ferran Torres, I like Ferran Torres, but 50 million euros only goes so far, you know, and he's not Messi. He's fine. He's a good signing. Interesting. So the goal briefly was almost accidental, wasn't it? In that, yes. Frankie de Jong had made a run and not received the ball, and so he was miles offside, wasn't he? And then Ferran Torres then makes a run and is picked out by Jordi Alba. Yeah.
Jordi Alba. Yeah.
And then obviously then Torres then runs beyond Frank de Jong, who's then onside. So Alaves are looking around for a flag, but it's you're not offside, yeah, are you? And that's it. But it's a bit of a lucky goal, isn't it, in that respect?
Yep. And we've spoken on the podcast about, I think, something that should be coached more.
Yeah.
But it de Jong did it by
it was an accident. Yeah.
Yeah. Did it by accident. But was bright enough to get back on the side for Torres's cutback.
Yeah.
And Torres was bright enough to realise that he didn't get caught offside and that de Jong wouldn't be offside.
Yeah.
So that's how they ended up winning the game, by luck, as you said, by accident. But no, I think Frankie de Jong he played all right. Him and Pedri were the two better players for Barcelona. And Ferran Torres showed one or two moments where you understand why they bought him, but it's a long way away from, which is quite surprising because when they played Real Madrid, they played extraordinarily well. And you then generally thought, you know, that I think by all accounts, they were proud of their performance. They disappointed they lost, but could see they were going in the right direction. And then last night, we get the performance like that. Perhaps it's on the back of losing to Real Madrid, then losing to Athletic in the Cup. Perhaps it's just knocked their confidence a little bit. So whether the pitch played a part, I'm not so sure. But it was an untidy performance from Barcelona. Atletico next week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when we come back, isn't it? Yeah,
it's going to be carnage. Yeah, the next game is going to be carnage with three at the back, four at the back. Who knows what's happening?
Yes, I want, if you're there, Terry, we want in-game updates on the formations,
minute by minute.
Yeah, I do like, by the way, I do like the fact that they're making real effort to give interviews in English. I know that's a bit biased from the international audience point of view, but it's good, isn't it? But Cunha,
yeah,
well, how can he speak such good English? And he apologised at the end for not.
I know. We're seeing real-time interviews with Ter Stegen and De Jong and Frankie De Jong. And it's quite refreshing, actually, to hear them admit we've got to do better.
Yeah.
We were poor.
Yeah.
We weren't good in English.
Yeah.
And you know, as you said, Cunha was, his interview was fantastic. Mm. I know Xavi speaks English. We've had one or two interviews with Xavi. I think it's a real selling point for La Liga TV. I was saying in the studio, this is great. You know, we need to advertise this more. People want to hear this. It's the English-speaking coverage, worldwide English-speaking coverage, and players appear to be willing to do it.
Well, they seem happy because especially people like Ter Stegen and De Jong probably have a different kind of conversation, can't they? Because what often happens, we get this in England, don't we, where Lukaku, for example, they go abroad, they speak more frankly in a different language, and then it comes back and causes a bit of a stir. Yeah. So in a sense, we're, as English speakers, we're seeing that the other way around here, aren't we? We're seeing, not that anyone said anything particularly controversial, but they said they were quite honest, the Barcelona players, weren't they? But particularly Frankie de Jong. I like him being interviewed. He's an intelligent kid, isn't he? So
exactly. And Ter Stegen come across well as well. Mm. I mean, it's difficult for goalkeepers to analyse a game, but he came across and said pretty much what Frankie de Jong said, that they need to improve. They're aware of the pressure, they're aware of the criticism they get, but and in last night's game, they weren't at their best. And it's great. I think it's a real selling point for La Liga too. People can hear a lot of people, you know, famous footballers from Barcelona and Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid and maybe Sevilla, that come on and speak English.
They should share it on social media, Terry. I'm afraid to say it's a bit of a social media blackout, isn't it, Lally? You know, you just don't, it's just not enough. It's almost like they're trying to keep it all secret, what's going on in La Liga sometimes with the social media coverage or lack thereof.
And also, I wonder if there's an element of the players in particular, and there'll be certain managers if they speak English, advertising the fact, I speak English.
With Cunha,
playing the Premier League.
If you heard that Cunha interview, you're thinking, all right, there's no problem with signing him for an English club then, is there? Because he speaks good English.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, let's have a brief break for podcast listeners. Maybe. Who knows? There's not an awful lot of advertising revenue around these days. So thank you to the Patreons, by the way. We'll come back because there's no game now. So we might do a Patreon Q&A or we might get someone on, Terry. We'll have to have a think, won't we? We've got a little gap now, haven't we? So unless you've been called up to go and play for Ecuador or something that you haven't mentioned.
I'll get in touch with Frankie de Jong, Ter Stegen and Matthias Kuhn.
Yes, I'm Kuhn, sure. Three of them can do a podcast. Yeah. Right, let's go to Betis next then. So welcome back. Right, so Betis keep banging in the goals, Terry. I think we spoke to Patreons on patreon.com/LTEL on Friday, and we mentioned, we discussed briefly Borja Iglesias, and you were saying how happy you were that a striker that doesn't look the part, but is in fact a good striker, is finding some form, is finding the form that is sort of, he's finding the goals that his performance is merit, and Betis are looking like a really exciting team. And then they went and won 4-1 away to Espanyol.
Yeah, no, and you know, they are the team to watch at the moment, aren't they? I mean, we've got other good teams in La Liga, but in terms of a purple patch, Betis are better. I mean, it's what Pellegrini has done there, the turning point has become, it's been a big change around because I may be repeating myself. Betis have been a good watch under Pellegrini, but they lacked that end product. And there was, you know, Lorin Maron was toiling around up front without ever getting a chance. Borja Iglesias, when he first came, was working hard, but not getting any opportunities. Wami wasn't scoring goals. And kind of when they bought William Jose, it was because they sort of realised that Lorin Maron wasn't working. Wami wasn't working. Borja Iglesias wasn't working. They needed a striker. So they went and got William Jose, and suddenly it's turned around where they're all scoring goals. And that's because there's been a big change around in what they're doing, how they're playing. You know, and they're not just all possession-based. There's possession with an end product. So they get the ball forward. They move the ball forward quicker. They get more players into attacking positions. Whereas when Pellegrini first took over, it continued from what previous managers have been doing, where there was a lots of possession, but no crosses into the box, no through balls. And it was hard going for the strikers. I looked at all the strikers they had, and I think Laura Moron as well. I think they're all, you know, you've got three decent strikers there who don't score goals and don't ever get any chances. So suddenly to turn that around is a clear directive from Pellegrini that they had to change. And now we're seeing the real impact of Canales' wonderful back heel to help provide one of the goals for Borja Iglesias. Borja Iglesias is, he's got all the attributes, you know, similar to Lucas Boye. If you're looking for a focal point up front, big, strong, quick, good touch, and a powerful player and a powerful finisher with a great attitude. to Sunday the money. He didn't take it easy on his former team in this game. And he's got a smile on his face. And you look at Betis when they're celebrating a goal and everybody's got a smile on their face. The players that are not involved in that game, because there's a decent rotation amongst the squad as well, where everybody feels part of what's going on at the moment. And they're just, they're the team to watch at the moment. Scoring loads of goals, they're great to watch. Individuals are brilliant. They're on fire, basically. I could have just said that.
Yeah, we can't just do, you know, the three-word summary of every team. let us go relatively quickly through the rest. Villarreal got a good result with, I think, 10 players out, including all of their forwards, Terry. I think the story? Yeah. Obviously, given a helping hand by poor old Franco Russo.
He was unlucky, actually. I don't think it's a penalty. The one that he gets sent off, I think the striker leans across and leans into him and is slow to take on the chance to finish and poles himself into Caruso. So it's a harsh penalty. Of course, then the sending off. He probably should have done better with the own goal. I thought Villarreal won that game, and I'll be brief. It was quite easy down the left flank. They had Pedraza and Alberto Moreno down the left flank, and Pablo Mafio was on his own, and they destroyed Mallorca down that flank. And then I think the intelligence and good play of Manu Trigueros, who was one of those players that was asked to play a different position because of the lack of strikers. Gerard Moreno injured, a couple of players away on African international duty, and then Juma missing as well. So Trigueros was asked to play almost like a second striker, almost like playing up front. And underrated player, podcast listeners know I'm a big fan. And he took his goal well, and from then it was a comfortable win for Villarreal in the circumstances.
Rayo Vallecano beaten at home for the first time by Irola's old club, of course, Athletic, and Nico Serrano, Terry, who players of popular football simulation computer games will probably know. He's a wonder kid, and he scored a cracking goal, didn't he? The young player, yeah.
18 years old, first start. He's made a few sub appearances. Player I don't know an awful lot about. And another young player that the Athletic Club seem to have found to go with Nico Williams and Vencedor and one or two others. It was a lovely left-footed volley. It's not one with the laces. He cuts across it with the outside of his left foot. So it's intentional to curl it towards the top corner, going back across goal, shooting from the left side of the penalty box. Brilliant stroke. 18 years old. And a big win for Athletic Club. If they can replicate their cup form in the league over the next few weeks and months, they might have an outside chance of top four. I mean, they're not a million miles away from it. But, we've seen what a proud club they are in cup competitions. They've got to do that on the league basis. And after the losing to Real Madrid in the Super Cup, beating Barcelona in the Copa del Rey, seven changes for this game showed the depth in the squad. And the first team to beat Rayo at home is a big achievement. Congratulations to Rayo for going this long with the unbeaten home record. Most of them wins. And it was quite ironic, really, that it was Athletic Club beating Iriola for the first time at home this season. But, an impressive performance from Athletic Club.
I've muted myself because the digger has started up again. We had a little window, but we've gone on too long, obviously. So three more games. We'll do them briefly. Levante, Terry, you've been making the case that Levante aren't done. They lose at home.
They are now.
They lose at home to Cadiz. And it's January. Alessio Lisky, the coach, basically starts talking about the mathematical. Oh, we're not mathematically down.
Instant dismissal. I think they've gone now. I think the loser in this game was in real trouble. Because of the gap between them and safety now is significant. And he made four changes, I think it was, in the team that won. Campagna was suspended, just leave it at that. And Morales was on the bench for the last game, so put him in instead of Campagna and just leave it. But he chose to make various changes in defence, and one of those, Postigo, was at fault for both goals. Pure and simple. You can't allow players to cross the ball as easy as he does. Negredo with a fine far post header, but the cross should never have got in the box in the first place. The centre-back goes out there. He's there. It's easy for him to stop it, but he doesn't. And then, likewise, he does it again on the second one. gets knocked off the ball, cut back across goal, Selby finishes it off. And a big boost for Cadiz, but I'm afraid now I think that's the end for Levante, particularly their manager. When he said it, I was in the studio, I thought, January. It's not mathematical. They've got to do a Getafe to get out of it, which I don't see them doing now. I saw them, if they won this game, that was their chance to get some confidence, momentum, get back to normality. But they look shell-shocked. They look to shambles. The win in the previous game against Mallorca, it didn't help. In this game, it didn't help them at all. So I'd see, you know, and I said it was hard to recognise teams that in a relegation battle, these two are, and Levante, I think, have gone now.
Yeah, literally 36-year-old Italian, their third coach of the season. It's a long time to go yet, isn't it? But whether it might be able to squeeze in another one. They'll get Paco Lopez back in. Right, so Real Sociedad 0, Getafe 0. Not as dreadful as it sounds, actually. It's, good rear guard performance by Getafe, and particularly their goalkeeper.
Yes, David Soria pulled up some fine saves. Astonishing, Real Sociedad. I think they're getting back to something like their best. But they've only scored 7 goals at home this season, which I found astonishing. I didn't realise that. Sometimes these little intricacies, you miss them. Like Valencia, I made a point of the week. Anyone saying the narrative is they're hard to break down, they're a hard team to beat. They've conceded 36 goals. They've got one of the worst defences in the league now. And you're thinking, no, they're not. They've scored 35, which is more than decent, but they've conceded 36. So that kind of tells you they're not hard to score against. They're not hard to play against. But because Bordalás is the manager, we think, oh, they're hard to play against. And likewise, Real Sociedad, that went unnoticed, that they've only scored 7 at home, so that needs addressing. But the players they've got, they should be scoring more than 7 goals at home. To still be in with a chance of challenging for the top 4 with just scoring 7 goals at home is surprising, to be honest. So, they weren't at their best. It was an evenly matched game. I like the signings that Getafe made. Oscar Rodriguez and Borja Mayoral played in this game. They're the only two changes. So I think that Kike Sanchez Flores has made Getafe difficult to beat, difficult to score against, and rightly so. I think so, ridiculous amount of clean sheets in the games that he's had as manager of Getafe.
Right, there we are, muted. And so we'll finish with Granada versus Osasuna. 2-0 win, important one for Osasuna, bad result for Granada. Henry sent us a tweet about an offside, Budimir given offside, and they drew the line. From it's a good point. I think he was offside anyway. Because how long are your sleeves is the question, isn't it? So where are you drawing? Because it's from the sleeve line. But of course, you can do the old Cameroon shirt, couldn't you, and have your sleeve line on your shoulder if you wanted to. or you could wear a long sleeve shirt. So I think they seemed to be going from his elbow, weren't they? But it didn't matter in the end. I think he was offside. I think I would have drawn the line there, not as offside as they made it look on the VAR. Basically,
yes.
In the end,
I agree with that.
It didn't matter in the end.
It's a real shame, though, that we lose game goals in football in general.
Yeah,
when they're that close, and level with that, it doesn't apply. There was a little campaign a little while ago, wasn't there? That level would be or reasonably level should be allowed. So we're losing goals. It wasn't controversial because Osasuna were absolutely brilliant in this game. They were superb for a team that have won 1 in 10. To play with the positive outlook they had. When you see the opening stages of the game, first 20 minutes, 25 minutes of the game, they must have had 4 or 5 attacks, but they got 6 or 7 players in the penalty box. And there was an element of surprise, I think, from Granada that, well, they didn't expect this, because that hasn't been how Osasuna have been playing. You know, I've criticised them. They play one up front and the two wingers, and they're going to get bodies into the penalty area, and Kike Garcia is ploughing a lone figure up front. But there was Chimi Avila and Antti Budimir in this game. But when they got the ball forward and they got the ball wide, they were flooding through from midfield. Moncayola was the player that had the goal disallowed. That gives you an element of how far the midfield were, but how much effort the midfield players were putting into getting into the penalty box. And they were brilliant after. David Garcia, the centre-back, has missed a few games. And I'm not sure there's a more valuable centre-back in La Liga than him. That was his fourth goal of the season, and he's a really, really solid, dependable, error-free, good central defender. So I'm not sure if it was Henry, but I know someone said keep it quiet, how well he's playing. Someone might come along and take him. Been linked with Atletico Madrid, and he has the hallmark of an Atletico centre-back, to be honest. So Towering had a great header for him to open the scoring. Kike Garcia comes off the bench and wraps it up, and they thoroughly deserve that. And it eases the relegation worries. You know, you're looking, they are now 10 points above relegation. They probably need another, at this stage, I would say 7 or 8 points, and they'll be safe. Because there was concerns about Arasati and his future because of the run of form they've found themselves in. So to attack the problem, to be positive, to attack it in the way they attacked it, with that positive outlook, surprised Granada, who were poor. And it's not often you get a manager do that. Normally the way is to, let's be hard to beat, let's you know, start off solid and see what they've got to offer. But no, he attacked it right from the very first minute in this poor run of form. That was refreshing to see Arasati do that.
Right, we will leave it there, Terry. So we'll be back and do something with the Patreons in the break. But enjoy your break, as if we don't need a break, because we hasn't been a lot of football in La Liga recently. It's had a break, and then a sort of half week off, a sort of hybrid break, and then an international break. There we are. That's the reality of it. So enjoy your break. Patreons, join us on Patreon, which would be great. As I said, there's only 10 people listening by the end, by the time the wrap-up comes. So thank you to those of you who are still with us. And we'll see you for another podcast soon. So take care, everyone. Bye-bye.